listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, and Hannah Francis. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Santiago Ortega. Special thanks goes to Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, and Farah Siddiqui. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Sherry Meredith.
And I'm Nate Kapp. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to discuss his latest story for the paper. It's called Judge Bars Grants Pass from Enforcing Anti-Homeless Ordinances While Lawsuit Continues. The order comes as the city seeks to hire former Trump homelessness czar as a consultant, stoking fears of a more destructive approach to the crisis. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So here we are again. Grants Pass homeless policies are the subject of lawsuits again. Catch me up here. What is the law at the center of this most recent suit?
Yes, Grants Pass cannot seem to stay away from legal challenges when it comes to homelessness. After their Supreme Court win, actually last year, the city has sort of tried a handful of things that are quite similar with regard to how they regulate homelessness in the city. This one, the claim comes from Disability Rights Oregon and the Oregon Law Center, who jointly filed this claim in January. It's only the second claim regarding the state law, House Bill 3115, that requires city's regulation of homelessness to be objectively reasonable. It also has a second claim in this lawsuit that says that a state law that essentially is this state law that aligns with the Federal American with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, that Grants Pass is in violation of that as well because they don't have sufficient accommodations for people with disabilities.
How has being homeless in Grants Pass changed since last year's Supreme Court ruling?
They have gone through a few phases, hardly any of which are building more affordable housing or creating overnight indoor shelters or emergency shelters or anything like that. The last August, as Street Roots reported, the city opened some designated camping sites. This one that's on J Street, just outside of downtown. And that held about 200 people in tents, and it was a gravel lot. It was a real humanitarian crisis. There was no water, no shade, despite temperatures being about 104 degrees the week after they opened them. They ended up on the first day of the new city council that took office on January 7th. They had an emergency meeting, and they closed that site and left people with only one other option that had been open a little bit closer in town next to the police station. But that site was much smaller, and so they really didn't have sufficient space for anyone, for everyone to go. And that's a big part of this lawsuit, is that people who are required to move throughout the day from that site, it doesn't hold the number of people who are homeless in Grants Pass, which is at least a few hundred.
So why did the judge issue a preliminary injunction? What does that mean in this case?
Right. So as the lawsuit is ongoing, a preliminary injunction, one of the important things about that is that the plaintiffs need to show that they're also likely to win the case in the long run. So this is basically in lieu of a temporary restraining order, which lasts for 10 days in Oregon. You have to go in every 10 days to the judge and ask for another 10-day temporary restraining order. At this point, they asked for the preliminary injunction, and then the judge spent a few days, took it under advisement, and then ended up doing that, meaning Grants Pass cannot cite, arrest, detain, or issue fines or prosecute any person in the city who's camping on public property, and they can't sweep residents from public spaces, with the exception of two parks where they've basically agreed that people cannot stay there, but they can stay in other places. While the city is creating sufficient space, they have to reach the same amount of capacity that they had at that J Street site that they closed.
Compliance with ADA is also a part of this. How has the city tried to address the accessibility issues at these sites?
Right. The bar is extremely low. I mean, two of the sites are basically, there are two that are open now, and they're required to move every 96 hours. So that's obviously a big challenge for people with disabilities with mobility devices. And essentially, in an effort to meet the very low standard, they have installed some compacted granite on the ground so that mobility devices can supposedly move across them. There's some, I talked to some sources down there who said that they're starting to kind of puddle, and people's kind of footprints actually kind of bury in there. So when it rains, it's not particularly great. But supposedly, this is in an effort so that the surfaces are hardened more rather than these big muddy gravel lots that they've had for the last little while. It's a pretty small step. It sounds like it is getting a little bit better, but it's still to be seen if Grants Pass is going to change the way that it's treating homeless people there with disabilities.
Well, the city council in Grants Pass is considering hiring on a Trump consultant on how to fix their problem. What do we know about this person?
His name is Robert Marbut, and he was Trump's director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness from 2019 to 2021. When Joe Biden took office, he left. And he is not in favor of Housing First. He very much criticizes it. He uses a lot of the same kind of tropes about homelessness and immigration and drug use that you hear from the Trump administration, who wants to essentially create these large camps and throw people in there and get treatment for them. He sort of advocates for this, what he calls housing forth, meaning that people need to get their lives in order before they can earn housing. And, that's something that kind of flies in the face of, Housing First advocates and research shows that, a lot of times people's issues that they may have resolve, mental health issues or, addiction issues resolve when people do go into housing. That's the whole idea behind Housing First. So he's running in quite the opposite direction of what the research shows. However, he aligns very much with this new, pretty right-wing city council that was elected as a slate in the same election that Donald Trump was elected just this last year.
So Marbut is very against a Housing First model. He's saying that that's the central problem, and that also sort of brings in things like vouchers, and which is something that is widely used. I wonder if you could talk about that point, and is there evidence to support the claim? I mean, he talks about the timing-wise that when the U.S. pivots to a more Housing First approach, that that's when homelessness got worse. Does that bear out in research?
Well, no. I mean, that is a real oversimplification, which is sort of exactly something that you might expect. Homelessness is clearly a multi-pronged issue, and housing affordability is something that he doesn't talk about a whole lot. He was in Grants Pass. The whole reason that the Grants Pass city councilors want to hire him as a consultant is because they saw him speak at something called the 2025 Patriot Conference in Grants Pass in mid-March. And there he really spoke about you know, the things that just kind of align with the way that the city councilors have spoken about this stuff, that like the rise in fentanyl is what caused homelessness, and that you can't talk about homelessness without talking about fentanyl, and you can't talk about fentanyl without talking about the border. And so it's sort of just throwing together a bunch of ideas and a bunch of tropes that really don't hold up to research. You know, like you're saying in your question, the voucher program is something that he has an issue with and says these are mostly just vouchers and they throw people into these places and they don't have any support. That's maybe sort of true, and certainly more supportive housing system is a great idea, and more supportive housing vouchers. But there's more than, you know, 745 Josephine County residents use housing choice vouchers. That's kind of the most common type of HUD voucher. And there's nearly like, you know, 37,000 Oregon residents who use that. It's really indeterminable, like, if people need support for their addictions or mental health supports or anything like that. These are just vouchers that pay so that people can stay in their homes. And again, you know, to kind of bring it full circle in a way, a lot of people who need these kinds of vouchers are people who cannot work for various reasons due to physical and mental disabilities. And so those housing vouchers are not only getting people into housing, they're also a bulwark against people becoming homeless, you know, in the first place, because they're able to continue to afford their housing.
You mentioned earlier that the Grants Pass City Council and the mayor were elected as a slate on a homelessness sort of agenda. I'm curious, as they've come into power very recently, of course, have their views or their strategies changed in that time now that they're actually in the driver's seat?
From the people that I've talked to there, it does seem as if there have been some sort of political stunts. You know, the first day they rescinded a grant from the only emergency shelter down there that was $650,000 that was going to help provide those services to people. They closed these sites. They, you know, got rid of a few things that the previous city council had done. And that's not to say that the previous city councilor was particularly progressive either, but so I think that some of the issue here is that the city attorney understands that they still need to align with the state law, but from multiple people that I've talked to, including the former mayor, it seems like they kind of had an idea that they could just do whatever they want because they got elected. And it turns out that you can't just do whatever you want just because you got elected to the Grants Pass City Council.
So where does this issue go from here now that there is this preliminary injunction from a judge and the lawsuit is ongoing?
Well, I talked to Tom Stenson from Disability Rights Oregon, and he said basically the question is at this point, how Grants Pass chooses to react. They can either change their policy, they could just live through this preliminary injunction and try to litigate the whole case out. They could ask an appellate court to try to take a look at that preliminary injunction. But from his perspective, you know, maybe the easiest thing and the better thing for everyone is that they would just reassess their policies.
To that point, did you talk to anyone who had examples of what might actually suffice for passing as objectively reasonable under state law or matching with what disabled folks need from these services?
Well, the objectively reasonable requirement is a little bit vague, understandably, but there are some things that are sort of guiding this from the state level. The governor's office is trying to send out, you know, a whole lot of money over the next year for more affordable housing. There are rules about shelters that receive state money in the state of Oregon. Cities have to have, you know, if they're going to create a shelter, they need to have hardened surfaces and doors and like heat and air conditioning, things like that, if they're going to be using state money. Grants Pass in the past in Josephine County has declined to use state money because they say, you know, quoting, they don't want to get into the business of homelessness. And so there are some pretty clear guidelines that, you know, we have state agencies that help cities do this all the time. The question is whether or not Grants Pass actually wants to, you know, take the bull by the horns and do that themselves.
What are the main takeaways that you hope folks get from this story?
Well, you know, this is only the second challenge under this claim against, you know, the saying that a city violated the objectively reasonable standard that came in 2023. The city of Portland was the other one. they kind of didn't build enough affordable housing. They just decided that they would sort of pivot in a certain way and have these new rules that basically, you know, if somebody declines an offer for reasonable shelter, then the city could, you know, cite or arrest that person. The thing is, the state law, it's been challenged. There have been people calling to repeal that. Just last week, there were some really important deadlines missed in the legislature, meaning that that is likely not going to be overturned anytime soon. And so the law stands. Cities cannot treat homeless Oregonians as though they are nothing. They need to consider the totality of the circumstances. And, you know, that's just kind of basic human stuff. So people can try everything that they want, but there are ideas that are lying around for people to use. Housing Fourth is not something that has been tested very much, but, you know, cities are going to try, and one day they may learn exactly what they could do.
If our listeners are interested in reading this piece for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest story for the paper. It's called Judge Bars Grants Pass from Enforcing Anti-Homeless Ordinances While Lawsuit Continues. The order comes as the city seeks to hire former Trump homelessness czar as a consultant, stoking fears of a more destructive approach to crisis. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, to talk through some of the latest arts news from her publication. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me. I always like being here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you back with us. Lots of interesting art news to talk about today. First, here is a story called Oregon Children's Theater to Pause All Shows and Activities. This theater has hit some financial troubles. What can you tell me about this story?
This is a big story for Portland and for Oregon, for the arts community. Oregon Children's Theater is one of the biggest arts organizations in the state. You know, there's a big five in Portland, like the symphony, but Oregon Children's Theater is right up there at, toward the top of that middle tier of organizations, really significant. Throughout the late aughts and into the teens, the leadership at Oregon Children's Theater was Stan Foote, who was the artistic director, and Ross McKean, who was the managing director. And they were this powerhouse team who was a really strong partnership. They worked together seamlessly, and they really built a solid reputation at that company that was nationally recognized, even beyond. Stan had this incredible knack for engaging with young people's literature, authors, and would commission new works based on those stories. And big names like Lois Lowry, they were really instrumental in contributing to the repertoire for children's theater, which would then be picked up and shown at other theaters across the country. So they had this sterling reputation. And in fact, anyone can look at their tax filings, their 990s over the years. And it's a good sort of look at the growth that they charted throughout the teen years. You know, they started with a budget that was around $2 million and grew it to well over $3 million during those years up through around 2019, 2020 and beyond. And Stan retired in 2019. And in 2020, when the pandemic came and, you know, really they'd been sitting on this very healthy, you know, gold mine of an organization, and Ross Ross was there, and when the pandemic hit and they had to close down, there was a difference of opinion in how they should downsize. Ross thought that some of the cuts that were being recommended by the board were a little too severe and maybe even not healthy. He thought they'd come to a good agreement, but the board fired him. The board president in particular, from what is known, did not agree with Ross's approach and fired him. And to understand that, Ross was a giant in the arts community, in the administrative side of managing arts organizations. He was hugely successful. He was very well known. He was a big ambassador, and obviously from how they had grown the company over so many years, you know, to that type of growth, that kind of astonishing growth, really speaks to the confidence that people had, funders had, to in the leadership at Oregon Children's Theater. And so when you fire somebody like Ross, who was absolutely beloved, beloved by everybody, and taught a lot of people. In fact, as I work, I often think, what would Ross do? How would he manage this, or what kind of approach would he take? And he honestly left a huge legacy with a lot of us who are working in the industry now. Somebody like that is let go. It really shakes the confidence from funders, big and small. That's really hard to recover from, and I don't think they have. But there are a lot of other factors as well at play here. They have performed at the Performing Arts Center downtown for many, many years, and it's getting more expensive to do that. I'm sure because the Performing Arts Center has its own expenses, but it's really pricing a lot of Portland companies out of the market where they can't afford to do that. And also, audiences have not returned since the pandemic in some ways. It has really hit in-person performing arts events more than anyone. They really had, over the years, there were a lot of school field trips. People would take their buses down, schools had loads and loads and loads of kids who would go downtown and see these shows. And I attended a lot of the performances, and they're super, super fun to see the kids' reactions to these shows. It's really heartwarming. And their productions were first rate. So the Oregonian had a story about this as well, and it explained how one of the factors, too, was that Kaiser Permanente ended the underwriting of the education programs at Oregon Children's Theater, which was around $900,000. So that's a massive, massive hit to a budget. So there are a lot of factors at play. It still really speaks to how unsteady a lot of arts groups are coming back. But at the same time, they've brought on some really energetic people on the board to right the financial ship. And so hopefully they're able to do that. Right now they are pausing their programming beginning in September, so hopefully they'll get back on their feet.
My understanding is that their educational programs, their camps, are still running this summer. Is that right?
Right, and signing up for those can really be a big deal into helping them to raise some funds. So they're on a campaign to raise at least $1 million to keep going. And, they have such a terrific history. They've been around for a long time. So they have a lot to still build on, and they have a lot of things going for them still.
Well, pivoting to other theater news, ArtsWatch also has a piece out about the Metro Area Theater Festival Fertile Ground, which gets started later this week. For folks who aren't familiar, what is Fertile Ground?
Yes, Fertile Ground. Gosh, I think this is their 16th year, which is just amazing. And Fertile Ground is where there's a lot of new works produced, new theater works. And so we have several stories at Oregon Arts Watch. And the one that was recently published by Linda Ferguson yesterday, her Drama Watch column, she talks about how the festival, she describes the festival, I think, in really good terms as organic and unpredictable, which I thought was spot on. So what you get is there will be 64 shows that range all over Portland and out to Hillsboro and Beaverton and Milwaukee and Lake Oswego, in theaters big and small. And it can be anywhere from, you know, an open mic kind of thing, or reading a new script, or a full-blown stage production. And it's over 16 days from April 4th through the 19th. And it's kind of fun to stumble on, you know, just about anything. And you get, have the opportunity to see these productions in a really raw form sometimes, and which makes it kind of exciting. The creators get to see how an audience reacts and how it plays out, and, you know, what they might tweak. But it's an opportunity to see something at the early stages of a production and anywhere in between, from the very beginning stages to more final stages. So, and everything. And it's so many people involved. It's kind of exciting to support them all and to see some of this. It's just kind of a giddy time for theater and a lot of new work. It's really important to support new work development.
Lastly, here is an article called Lego Vampires, Cruise Ships, and Quonset Huts Q&A with Skylab Architecture's Jeff Koval. This is an Oregon Arts Watch. This architecture firm has some pretty notable structures in and around the Northwest, including the house that was used in the Twilight movies, which was recently made into a Lego set, hence the title of the piece. Can you tell me a little bit about Jeff Koval and Skylab Architecture?
When the editor Bob Hicks told me this story was coming, I don't think he had the story yet, and he said that he had a story coming from Brian Libby, who's always a terrific writer, always really fun to read Brian's work, and he really knows architecture, so this is a treat. But Bob described it as, there's this vampire house in Portland, and a Lego model has been made after it, and I just looked at him. What are you talking about? So it was fun to see the story actually get published and be able to figure out what was going on. And so Jeff Koval, who is the architect at founded Skylab Architecture in 1999. I'll go back to the vampire house to start with. Like, where do you start here? And designed a house. It's close to Forest Park. It's called the Hoax House, H-O-K-E, as he calls it. And it's built near Forest Park. It was initially bought by an executive at Nike. It's now has a different owner. And much to his surprise, apparently, initially it was used. It was used for the Twilight movies, and it's where Edward Cullen, the vampire Edward Cullen, lives. So in Lego had some type of opening where people could submit ideas for new Lego models, and somebody had recommended the Cullen house in the movies, and they went with it. And the architecture firm actually didn't know about this, so it was kind of a fun story. But then the story goes on and talks about how Skylab has grown over the years, how when the movie, the first Twilight movie first came out, that the firm had about 10 people, and they all went to see the movie together, and that was kind of fun, and had no idea that it would become a series of 5 movies. I guess he wasn't aware of just how big of a deal that the Twilight book series by Stephanie Meyer was and is. So 5 movies in, you know, this house is a big deal, and it actually attracts a lot of tourists in Portland for a private residence. But then, you know, Brian talks with Jeff, and just all the things that Skylab is doing. They have had a hand in designing parts of a cruise ship, which sound really innovative. And then now he's even working on a village in Park City, Utah, that will be part of the Olympic Village in a few years when the Olympics are hosted there. So it's a fun story talking with Jeff Covell about all of this.
He had some designs for the Harvey Milk Plaza and some concepts around that. That was cool to see those photos and hear talk about that too.
It was. I'm glad you brought that up. They're kind of hoping that some of these ideas gain traction, that some of these streams there that are now underground, that maybe they can come up to the surface, and some of the ideas to help mitigate some of the problem areas of Portland that have unsavory activity. So I think part of this is just, these are some kind of urban planning ideas that could happen in this area. And it would be curious to find out down the road whether any of this gets traction.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about any of the stories we talked about today, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can find out all this information and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
That was Laura Grimes, Executive Director at Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest arts news from her publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you'll hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our fantastic programmers, including specials for Black History Month and